The Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Terry presiding.
But they were letting me come out by myself.
Well, good morning, everybody. Please be seated. First of all, I'd like to welcome Senior Justice Shearing and her family. Justice Shearing will be receiving the Legacy of Justice Award after our argument at 11:30, around 12:05. And we look forward to honoring Justice Shearing for many, many reasons, which Justice Sada will present. Now, you can see there's six of us. Justice Michael Douglas is out of the state attending a conference that involves non-English-speaking people who appear in court and interpreters and things like that. So he'll listen to the arguments, and then we'll conference with us later when we embank again later in this month. So our first case this morning is case number 59507, Sandpoint Apartments LLC versus District Court. We have Mr. Flansburgh for the petitioners, Mr. Posenberg for the real parties in interest. Mr. Flansburgh, you ready?
I am, Your Honor.
And for the record, Frank Flansburgh and Mark Kierbach coughing, reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure.
May it please the court, the heart of the issue before you today is whether the legislature intended the effect of having this statute applied to pending cases. Because regardless of how we characterize that effect, how we label that effect or describe that effect, whether it's prospective, retrospective, remedial, or otherwise, if that was the effect that was intended by the legislature, it need only be a constitutional exercise of the police power. And in fact, the Landgraf test, as adopted by this court, that's the first inquiry. We do not get to the second inquiry of whether something is impairing a right or imposing an additional liability for a past conduct unless the intent is unclear. In this case, it is not. We always start with the language of the statute itself, much like we did in Madera when we looked at what maintain meant, or Great Basin when we looked at what it meant to be a pending protest. We look at the plain language of the statute that was adopted by the legislatures themselves when they voted unanimously in favor of this law. The language is, if the person seeking the judgment acquired the right to seek the judgment from someone who previously held the right. So upon enactment, if you were a person in the present tense of seeking a judgment, and who in the past tense had previously acquired a right to do so, the statute applied to you. The intent from the legislature is manifest in the language itself. Even if we were to turn to legislative history, which I don't think is necessary here today, even if we were to turn to legislative history, we've included it all in our record, pages 952 to 1082 of the record, and we have the entire record before you. But I would like to focus on something of the legislative history that's important, and that is the second piece of the puzzle that the legislators have when they cast their unanimous vote in favor of the statute. They have the language of the statute, which we've already addressed, and they have the Legislative Council Digest summarizing the bill for them. In the Legislative Council Digest, it specifically said that this statute would become effective upon passage and approval and thus apply to any deficiency judgment awarded on or after the date of enactment.
Isn't that the key term, though, deficiency judgment, as opposed to when a cause of action may accrue or an action is filed?
Yes, I think so. The statute uses the term seeking the judgment. And the judgment that they're seeking from the inception of the action is the deficiency judgment that's specifically provided pursuant to NRS 40.455. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Well, and then that judgment was entered when?
That's the point in this case, thank
right.
you. That the judgment, thank you, the enactment of this statute is pre-judgment, meaning that the fair market value hearing, at which time you will determine the amount of any judgment, is in the future, after the date of enactment. So as this law was enacted, it applied to, this statute was an intervening statute addressing prospective relief, which was the judgment that would be adopted after the 457 hearing.
But the foreclosure sale preceded
the enactment of AB 273, correct?
It did.
And furthermore, the language you just read before Justice Perguerre asked you a question describing that it applies to any deficiency judgment, that language was not from the legislature, was it? That language originated with the Legislative Council Bureau, who is not elected by the citizens.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So it really is not legislation. It's at best some species of legislative history.
Correct. The plain language, which I addressed earlier, the person seeking the judgment, that's the plain text of the statute. The Legislative Council digest is indicative of legislative intent. In fact, this court in Nevada Protection for Property Rights, in fact, looked to the Legislative Council digest for instruction on legislative intent. The Legislative Council is statutorily obligated to summarize the bill for the benefit of the legislators. And my point then, with respect to going to the Legislative Council digest first, is when the legislators vote on the enactment, they have two things in front of them, the digest and the text of the statute. So you're right. It is not the express language.
It was not enacted. It's an explanation contemporaneous of.
Absolutely right, Your Honor. It's just indicative of legislative intent. That's all. Moreover, we can look to the historical background and the environment in which this law was enacted for legislative intent. One thing in the historical background is that the legislature was not legislating on a blank slate, because this court had previously decided Holloway v. Barrett, in which this very statute had been applied to pending cases when it was enacted. That's part of the history of this statute that the legislature is presumed to know and is also indicative of the legislative intent. Even further, the environment in which this law was enacted is among the foreclosure crisis. The legislature made a policy decision to favor entrepreneurs and owners over successor creditors to not allow the deficiency judgment statutory scheme become a profit center. That's a policy choice that they made in this environment to help my clients, to help clients of other people in the room today, not for the next cyclical downturn. But also, one thing I don't want to lose is that we've also looked to what the legislature has done subsequently to confirm its intent. In public employee benefits, for example, we looked at the 2007 adoption of a statute for confirmation of the 2003 intent. In this case, the court ordered sua sponte for the legislature to file an amicus brief. When that amicus brief was filed, the legislature took the position that this statute is prospective and it applies to any action that's pending. But what's more importantly about the legislature brief is that what it said is, even if you characterize that effect as retrospective, it's inconsequential. Because the legislature, it's undisputed, the legislature has the power to enter laws with prospective or retrospective effect. It just need be a valid exercise of the police power. On the constitutionality of this law that was approved by our legislature, the primary objection raised by the respondents is the contract clause. The contract clause, however, doesn't apply in this situation because, as this court has ruled in Holloway v. Barrett, adopting Guilford v. State Bank of New York, that rights to a legislative formula for determining deficiencies is not a right that vests into the party's contract. So therefore, a law that modifies that deficiency calculation is not impairing a right. Having said that, I don't want to lose focus that even if you applied a contract clause analysis, the Energy Reserve case from the United States Supreme Court supports that this would be a rational basis level review, because you have an impairment on an industry that's been historically regulated. You have a non-government interested interest, and you have a limitation on an expectation of profit. That level of impairment is low. And so the court looks for a legitimate public interest and a rational relation to that interest, deferring to the legislature. The Dormant Commerce Clause raised in a footnote, this court's decision in Douglas County v. Weehaw, would stand for this similar proposition. That's a rational basis level of review. Addressing preemption for a moment, there is no doubt there is no express preemption. There is no argument of implied preemption of impossibility. The only argument is a conflict preemption of obstacle. However, we know from Nano Pierce and from Rolf Jensen that statutes that in which areas which states historically legislate, a statute is presumed not to be preempted. That is that it is the proponing party that's complaining of the constitutionality to support evidence that there is an obstacle. And in fact, we've cited cases out of the Seventh Circuit, the Frank Brothers case, that needs empirical evidence. In this case, there's no evidence of an obstacle. In fact, to the contrary. We know that states from Alaska to Washington, with Nevada in between, have completely eliminated the right to a deficiency in certain contexts. Those statutes are not preempted. We know that this court in Shetler v. Railron just recently applied a Chapter 40 defense that was not barred under FERIA to an FDIC-related entity. And we know of no case in which deficiency legislation has ever been preempted under any context.
Could I take you back to Holloway for a moment?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're relying a great deal on the Holloway case, but as I understand it, the foreclosure sale in Holloway, per footnote 4, postdated the effective date of the new anti-deficiency legislation, whereas in this case, the sale was a fait accompli by the time the AB 273 took effect. Is that correct?
That is correct.
What do you make of that difference and your reliance on Holloway?
I believe at this point, post-1969, it's a distinction without a difference. And the reason is because prior to 1969, there were only two components that went to determine a deficiency. I see my rebuttal time is, may I continue to finish my answer?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Prior to 1969, you had to know the amount of the indebtedness and the credit bid. There was no judicial determination of what the deficiency judgment would ultimately become, because all you had to know were those two things. Post-1969, when Nevada adopted the deficiency scheme, we now need to know multiple things. Whether the trustee sale was conducted pursuant to NRS 107, whether guarantors received notice, whether there are any defenses that are otherwise not waived under 453. We have to know that there was an application within 6 months after the day of the trustee sale pursuant to 455. We have to know the fair market value. So all of those things are in flux until the time enters the deficiency judgment. So while the court did not say in Holloway that it would not apply it to a pre-sale enactment, I think that reading between the lines and trying to infer that, I think it's a distinction without a difference. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, Your Honors, I believe that the statute is a constitutional exercise of the police power, and it is exactly what the legislature intended. Therefore, we ask that the appropriate writs shall issue. Thank you.
You still have 3 minutes and 42 seconds for a rebuttal. Mr. Rosenberg, on behalf of your parties in interest.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Dan Pulsenberg for the Real Party in Interest. A petitioner seems to have retreated from some of its arguments in its petition. Let me address what seems to be a logical order, at least to me. First of all, they're arguing now that it doesn't matter whether we consider this to be prospective application, retrospective application, or anything else. But their main argument in their petition is that it is a prospective application to apply 2011 AB 273, which is NRS 40.4591C, to pending claims for a deficiency judgment. Well, that's just wrong. That applying them to pending claims of vested rights is a retrospective application. Judge Gonzalez cited Nevada Power versus Metropolitan Development in her order, as we did in our brief. And that's a case where this court said, no, you cannot apply statutes of repose to vested rights, vested claims for constructional defects. And in a supplemental authority, I mentioned the Rice versus Watkins case and the Buck versus Greyhound case. Rice versus Watkins said you cannot apply 41.141, the comparative negligence statute, to a pending claim unless the legislature specifically said so. Now, that's a case, I mean, if we're talking about the difference between comparative negligence and contributory negligence, that, if anything else, is a calculation of damages, just as they're arguing now that this statute is. But this court said, no, you cannot apply it to a to an existing right unless the legislature specifically said so. And in Buck versus Greyhound, this court, I'm no great fan of Buck versus Greyhound, but in this court said you cannot apply 41.141, an amendment to it, to a pending claim because a statute that changes the amount of money somebody can receive or that somebody has to pay affects vested rights. And that's what we're doing here. We're applying this to a claim, not just to a for deficiency judgment. Remember, this is a case where there wasn't a transfer after the foreclosure sale. The only supposed transfer here is after the failure of Silver State Bank, when the FDIC acquired the rights and put them, contribute them into Multibank, a limited partnership, an entity that would exist to pursue these claims, which the FDIC is obligated to do. Now, that affects those rights. That affects pending rights. Those are vested rights whether they're reduced to judgment or not, and this court has repeatedly said so.
What do you do with Holloway?
Holloway is different because, as this court said in Holloway, quoting the Gelford case, where Justice William O. Douglas said, a borrower is not entitled to a double recovery. And all the statute did in Holloway is say that there is an offset either for the amount of the foreclosure sale or for the fair market value. And the Gelford case and this court, too, in Holloway, repeatedly said it doesn't affect the right to full recovery. Allowing an offset for the fair market value simply allows the borrower to get full value, not double recovery. This case goes further. This case limits the amount. I don't think this statute does what petitioners say it does. But they are arguing that this limits the right of my clients to pursue their existing loan that was transferred to them. Now, there are a lot of arguments we could go into as to how the transfers were made, and I don't think the statute applies in this circumstance, even if it applies retroactively. But Holloway is a different animal entirely. Holloway is a case that didn't affect vested rights because you have no vested right to a double recovery. Just as this court said in PEBP, the Public Employees Benefit Program case, there Justice Hardesty said there was no statutory right not to contribute into a benefits program. So we're looking here not at a statutory scheme such as workers' compensation or retirement benefits. We're looking at the rights under the contracts. Remember, we're not just talking about the deed of trust here. We're talking about the loan agreement, and we're talking about the note. So those are vested rights, and you cannot apply this to vested rights, and certainly not in a situation here where there was not the clear expression by the legislature to do so. There is nothing in this statute. There's nothing in this enactment that says that it would apply, not in what the legislature passed, that it would apply to pending claims, not claims, to pending loans, to pending rights, to pending obligations.
Mr. Poulsenberg,
Your Honor.
In an opinion that would agree with your position, would it be necessary to clarify the definition of vested claims or vested rights under Holloway?
I think it is self-evident if the court feels that it's necessary to do that. I think Holloway was a pretty clear decision in what it was talking about, what the rights were.
How do you address counsel's response to Justice Pickering's suggestion that there's a difference? He seems to think that it's a distinction without a difference.
Well, I think the primary difference when it comes to Holloway is the fact that Holloway talked about there being no right to receive more than full reimbursement. And in this case, we're talking about getting less than full reimbursement on the loan. I think that's the crucial distinction in this case.
Well, but his argument is legislatively the decision is the same, that they're saying you can get what you paid for this bundle of rights, but you can't get any more than you actually paid.
Well,
I mean, that's his perspective on this statute. So you still do have the distinguishing Holloway problem, even though it's not technically a double recovery. They're cutting out the upside.
Well, not in this case, because we're not talking about a situation
here. Fair enough,
here.
Yeah.
We're not talking about a situation here where there was the foreclosure sale and then a transfer of the right to recover the deficiency judgment. This was all before the enactment of the statute. The FDIC transferred all rights in 345 loans to Multibank. So this is a completely different situation we're talking about.
Mr. Polsenberg, could you address the method of transfer here? It seems to me that this preemption question is important in the context of an FDIC series of transfers, as discussed in Round Rock.
I would have to agree with you that it's important, but I would also have to note that I don't think the petition has done a very good job of raising all these issues. If this court, I think this court could look at the retrospective application, but if it goes further than that, I mean, you're really addressing issues that have not been properly developed either in the district court or in this court. But I do think, yes, this is a situation where if the court, if a state were allowed to enact a statute that reduced the FDIC's rights, you would be looking at serious preemption issues. Now, they make arguments about this not being an express preemption. They make it more here and in their reply brief. They never bothered to raise these issues in the petition. But going to the mechanics of the transfer on our finding of fact number 14, Judge Gonzalez talked about the assignments of the loans being merely a contribution of the loans to its subsidiary, and that, therefore, no consideration was actually paid. And so what we're looking at here, I would say, would be something like the interim case, the federal district court case where Judge Dawson said that everything that is transferred without limitation. Now, this court said that as well in an unpublished decision earlier this year in Volks. I hesitate to mention an unpublished decision. I think it's the elephant in the room that we all know about in this situation. But I do have published decisions, and I do have UCC Article 3 and Article 4 cases that would say that Multibank and my client, the special purpose entity, get full rights under the transfer, and they cannot be diminished just because of the mechanism. Let me turn to the fact that the legislature did not express the intent to have this apply retroactively. And they did not. If you look at the legislative history, in March, the Assembly Judiciary Committee is talking about should this be applied retroactively. Assemblyman Conklin says no. He goes so far as to make my contracts clause argument better than I could ever make it, and say it would be improper to apply this to pending loans. It would be improper to limit the rights of contract. It would make Nevada an anathema, and honestly, a state, and I think he's right, where nobody would want to conduct business. Because if the legislature could just go and change existing rights and existing obligations under contracts, that would be, who would want to do business here, let alone to lend money? I mean, the economy has hit Nevada worse than any other place. And I understand the legislature was trying to do something about that. But their interpretation of this just undermines the ability to have financing to dig our way out of this hole. Now I understand those kind of questions are legislative and policy-based, and this court doesn't necessarily take them up. But the legislature certainly seemed to say that this was not retroactive. And we quote at length in our briefs about that in the March hearing. Somehow, though, the bill changed. And what the what the petitioners are relying on is a line in the legislative digest that says that the amendatory provisions of Section 5 become effective upon passage and approval and thus apply to a deficiency judgment awarded on or after the effective date. It isn't saying that is the legislative intent to have this apply. It's saying that it is an incorrect conclusion from an accepted premise. It says that Section 5 becomes effective in passage upon approval, and yes, that was changed in May to make it effective upon signing by the governor. And then they say, thus, ergo, therefore, it applies to deficiency judgments awarded on or after the effective date. Well, that's just legally wrong for the reasons that I have discussed. You cannot apply it to a pending claim. And their entire position is based on either an inartful or an incorrect legal conclusion drawn by the Legislative Digest. So as my friend Dan Waite says, Legislative Digest is kind of like a West head note. It's persuasive if it's right, but it's not persuasive if it isn't right. They rely a great deal on the Madeira case, and Madeira was a different situation in two regards. First of all, in Madeira, this court, and construing Madeira in Star Insurance versus Neighbors, this court made clear that in that situation, the statute was absolutely clear. The same standard I'm saying is necessary to rebut the presumption of prospective application only. The statute was clear that it applied to pending claims. Now, remember, that was after the Faline case, Faline versus GNLV, where this court came up with what I will say was an innovative approach to handling workers' comp bad faith claims. And within the month, the legislature overruled this court and said, no such claims can be initiated or maintained. And this court went so far as to say that when the legislature said no claims can be maintained, that means an existing claim cannot go forward. So there you had a clear legislative intent to apply it retroactively. And there we're dealing about, you know, the petitioners talk a lot about rights versus remedies and calculation versus vested rights. There we're talking about a statutory scheme, workers' compensation, where when the legislature does come in and change things, they're changing an area where they basically have free control. It's statutorily based, much as the public employee benefits program is. So when there's a change made, it's remedial. You can't make the same change to an existing contract, right? That
is it your remedial. Position that this statute only applies to loans created after its effective date?
Yes, and that was Judge Gonzalez's position, too.
Okay, and that's your core position here?
That's my core position. I don't have to go anywhere near that to win this case because the loan was back in 07, and the transfers were before the statute, and the foreclosure sale was before the statute. But I don't see in good conscience how you can read this statute without that being the conclusion. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Pillsbury. Mr. Flansburgh, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. What controls the disposition of this case is the legislative intent. As long as it's a constitutional exercise of the police power, at an end. Intent does not need to be expressly stated within the statute itself. We can look at the manifestation of the intent in the language, but this court in these types of cases always looks to legislative history. We did so in Great Basin, and we did so in Madeira.
Isn't it fairly apparent, though, when you look at the legislative history and the statements by Senator Conklin that was not intended to be retroactive?
That's a good point. I'd like to address that. In March, one of the other things we look at legislative history is how the bill changed from introduction versus enactment. When this was introduced, it had a restricted application date. The entire bill was restricted to only post obligations July 1, 2011. And that's how it was introduced in March. After March, the bill went through amendments. Different sections have different effective dates. Section 5.5, for example, is effective to new actions. Sections 1 through 3 is effective to new obligations. This section on May 19, 2011, with Legislative Council Bureau in the room discussing the effect, suggested that the effective restriction date be deleted from this statute. And this court has, in McKellar v. McKellar, looked at the deletion of a restriction, the deletion of an effective piece, to be indicative of legislative intent. The fact that that restricted application was deleted is indicative that it was intended to apply. Also, the statements between Mr. Conklin and whoever else was in the meeting, Mr. Atkinson, I believe, was not before the legislators when they're casting this vote. That was an assembly committee. Those things, that wasn't part of the vote when they cast their unanimous vote in favor of this statute. What they had before them was the language of the statute itself. I'd like to address preemption for just a moment. There's just no evidence of preemption. This court can always consider constitutionality issues, State v. Miller, whether it's fully briefed below or not. And in this case, there's no evidence of a preemption issue. In fact, the concept of banks running for the hills hasn't happened since 2009 when this state outlawed deficiencies entirely for purchase money mortgages. That hasn't happened. Hasn't happened in the half a dozen other states that eliminate the right to a deficiency in other contexts. So there's just no evidence of a FERIA preemption. There's no case to suggest to the contrary regarding deficiency legislation. It's historically legislated by the states. Regarding the prospective, the law is prospective, just like it was in public employee benefits. And the cases cited, Rice, Buck v. Greyhound Travelers, those things that were filed last week, those things all increase liability, joint and several liability, comparative negligence. You're increasing liability for past conduct. That's not what this is doing. This is a remedy. It is calculating the amount of damages. Because when they talk about a vested right, they blend the right. This is not a right to a deficiency judgment. Nobody has that right until the court weighs the evidence. The right to seek a deficiency is unabridged. No one has abridged that right. The right to a deficiency judgment does not exist and is not a vested right. But I don't want to get lost, because the one thing that wasn't addressed by the respondent, legislative amicus brief, it says its intent is that this apply to this effect, the pending cases. And that resolves the question today. May I conclude?
Yes, please, to finish your thought.
In this economic condition, with the legislature making the policy choices it did, it adopted a statute within its constitutional police power and should be enforced as it intended in the writ should issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Flansburg. Thank you, Mr. Posenberg, for your arguments and briefs in this matter. Very informative. This matter will stand submitted.